Network, proudly presents The Jay's Blade Show. With your host, CyberGolf.com's own Jay Clemmer, and co-starring a galaxy of the golf and sports world's greatest names as a special guest. Yo, 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 this is your main man, DJ Q, telling you to put your hands together for your friend and mine, Jay Clemmer.
All right. Thank you, DJ Q, for bringing us back into the show in style. He is the best producer in the business, and he's absolutely right. I am Jay Flemma, and you're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network. Jay's Plays is brought to you by JB's Best Hot Sauce. It's the hot sauce made by a golf writer, and it is spicy and bold and flavorful. It's on every table in the Deep South, and it should be on yours when it says JB's. It's the best. So also, big thank you to Phish for letting me use their music as the theme song to the show. And to our very first guest, Peter Kessler. He was fantastic to have on for two long segments. And now we have another phenomenal guest. For many decades, he has been the voice of the great American sportsman of the Midwest. He's written for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's published in numerous magazines. Please give a warm Jay's Plays welcome to the man who wrote the book on Aaron Hills, Gary D'Amato.
Hey, Jay, how you doing?
I'm terrific. You know, we're mere days away from the starter's gun of the national championship.
It's pretty exciting, isn't it? I mean, it is for Wisconsinites, that's for sure, considering that the U.S. Open has never been held in our state. 116 years of history, and this is number one in Wisconsin, so it's exciting.
Well, you guys deserve it, okay? Year in and you out, you and Minnesota do battle for most golfers per capita, but pretty much that also means most ardent golf fans as well. I remember Pete Dye commenting about how you fans were doing the wave around the 17th green at Whistling Straits in 2004. You were so excited to have a major finally back in Wisconsin. The last one before that was Blue Mound, and I think it was 1933, wasn't it?
That's correct. Gene Sayers in the Blue Mound. Very good, Jay.
Oh, I have my moments occasionally on that. You're going to get a chance at a trivia question, too, later on in the show. But for right now, you wrote the book on Aaron Hills, so tell us a little bit about the book, where people can buy it, what it was like to write it, and your experiences at the golf course in putting it together.
Sure. I sort of had this idea that the U.S. Open was coming to Wisconsin. Why not do a nice coffee table book on Aaron Hills? Because I know a photographer named Paul Hundley, who's, I think, the best golf course photographer. I know there's a lot of good ones. Paul's outstanding, and his work at Aaron Hills is just phenomenal. And so we teamed up. We sold it to a publisher, Classics of Golf, and Aaron Hills, the golf course, was on board with it. And I did the text, Paul did the photos, and believe me, you'll buy this book for the photos and not to read my words, that's for sure. It's a beautiful book, it really is.
I kind of doubt that, but go ahead.
So we worked at it for about 6 months together. Classics of Golf is a publisher. They do high-end coffee table books, very good publisher. And the book is available at the course's website, aaronhills.com, and also at classicsofgolf.com, the publisher's website. And we're going to be doing some signings in the merchandise tent next week, so we're stoked for that.
Will there be a little signing event either in the media center or in the merch tent?
Yeah, we're going to have three signings in the merch tent on Sunday coming up, and then on, I believe, Tuesday and Thursday of the championship week. So it's a busy week already, as you know, covering the U.S. Open. So it's going to be hard to steal away for a couple hours to do signings. But I look forward to it. I just hope that, you know, it's funny, Jay, I don't know if people buy a book at the U.S. Open because they certainly don't want to lug around a big coffee table book all day. So I'm hoping people buy it, but if not, we'll sit there and twiddle our thumbs for 2 hours.
Well, I think you're going to have a long line. People will be very excited. It's a fascinating story how it was built, and it's a fascinating, interesting golf course with all sorts of golden age strategies. I wrote in my preview for the Golf News Net and on jflemmett.com that Aaron Hills is 11 years old, but it looks 111 years old because it was really formed 11,000 years ago when the glacial ice receded.
Yeah, that's right. We have a glacial feature in Wisconsin called the Kettle Moraine, which is geologists from all over the world come and study here, the central part of Wisconsin. And these retreating glaciers all those thousands of years ago left behind some really interesting land formations, kettles and swales and ridges and mounds. And the golf course was just laid right over those landforms. It was just basically a skin of turf over those great bones. And you talk about minimalist designs. I mean, I know that's the hot buzzword right now in golf course architecture. This really was a minimalist design. They only moved dirt on two holes during the initial construction. The fairway corridors were there. The green sites were there. They just had to lay some turf down on them. So it's pretty phenomenal in that regard.
And, you know, when you bring up the word minimalism, I said in my article that we had three of the high priests of the Holy Church of Minimalism who did the design. Mike Herdson and Dana Fry, who for many years were an architecture firm together, and golf writer and golf critic Ron Witten of Golf Digest, you know, the foremost thinker on the craft who at the time wasn't an architect, but, you know, he's our great lion of a writer slash golf course critic. So in a way, it was a bit of a perfect storm to have these homespun guys, these laid back, you know, they don't get a lot of fanfare from the intelligentsia all that much. You don't hear their names on TV all the time, but here they are and they come in and, you know, Herdson and Fry, and then Witten on his very first attempt, get a U.S. Open and get a U.S. Open for Wisconsin. It's really a feel-good story.
It really is. You know, as Herdson, Mike Herdson told me himself, he said, people consider us second-tier architects. He said, we're not considered in the same strata as Nicklaus and Dye and Corin Crenshaw and Tom Doak. But he said, this just validates that we do good work, and they do. I mean, not only did they do Aaron Hills, but at the same time, they did a course in Wisconsin Dells about an hour and a half north called Wild Rock. And it's a beautiful, it's a great resort course. So they do good work. And Ron Witten kind of, I mean, talk about luck, you know, Herdson asked him, hey, do you want to, we've talked about doing a project together for a long time. I've known you for many years, Ron. How about you join us and, you know, lend your voice to this project? And Witten said, oh, sure. Okay. Why not? Turned out he helped design the U.S. Open golf course, so he calls himself one of the luckiest guys on earth. But he brought a lot to the project too. He's very, very knowledgeable, as you said.
Now, here's what I said about Ron. He talked the talk, and then he walked the walk in the biggest way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really interesting. They had so many voices out there. You know, they had the three architects. They had Bill Kubley and Steve Posler, who from Landscapes Unlimited, designing the course or building the course. They had Rod Whitman, who's a great architect in his own right.
Yes, was the very much so.
Yeah, very much. And then the owner, Bob Lang, didn't know anything about golf when he started. And by the time the course was halfway through construction, he was calling a lot of the shots, digging bunkers himself. And so you had all these voices and this creative tension out there. But I think what it did was, it was such a collaborative process with so much arguing along the way that it turned in, that every decision was made with a lot of forethought, and it turned into obviously a great golf course.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring up Bob Lang, okay? One of my thoughts is that if an owner's going to try to start to dig in the dirt himself, he needs to do a lot of studying first. Take, for example, a guy like Eric Bergstahl, who, you know, studied at the elbow of Tom Fazio on how to build the golf course before he started out on his own. You know, and then boom, finally, after, you know, on his 12th try, he builds Bayonne, which is his magnum opus, one of the great golf courses of the world. You know, Bob Lang, I have to say, I had a good laugh when I heard the story about how Witten sent him on a dream trip to prairie dunes and sandhills, and he came back and said he didn't like it. There weren't enough trees.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, That's like Zeus saying to you, come up to Olympus for a tour, and as he's bringing you around, says, by the way, Neptune's packing it in. Would you like to jump? And you're saying, no, I don't like sushi. Now,
yeah,
the golf course, it's... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Bob, you're absolutely right, Bob. What, he has an artistic flair. I mean, he rebuilt a town in near Milwaukee called Delafield with a lot of colonial-style buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very artistic, but I mean, you're right. He knew nothing about golf, and by the time the project was done, he sort of fancied himself a budding golf course architect.
Well, now happily, Andy Zeigler stepped in and stewarded, and I choose that word with precision, stewarded the course. Watching carefully. He did what I tell a lot of my clients as an entertainment lawyer. I say, oh, you're the money? You may remain so long as you remain silent. Pay attention. You'll see how genius creates a legend. And that's exactly what he did, and after a few tries of that, as you study longer, that's when you get your chance to make, design changes and such. But happily, the course came out phenomenal. So let's talk about the bones of the golf course itself. Very unusual, first time since 1992, we're going to have a par 72 golf course with four par 3s and four par 5s. All four par 5s are over 607 yards, including the gargantuan 18th at 663.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the winning score is going to be?
Well, I look at this two ways, Jay. If the wind blows hard, which it tends to do at this time of the year in Wisconsin, especially up there, it's kind of an exposed piece of ground. So if the wind blows hard, I think, a couple under will be the winning score. However, if we get a weird weather week and it's still, or we get a front moving in and we get fog and drizzle and then it's still for a few days, I think they'll rip that course up, because length without wind, as you know, means nothing to those guys. The course needs wind to defend itself, but all indications are that it's going to blow, at least 15 to 20 miles per hour at least a couple days, and maybe from different directions. So I think par is going to be a very good score.
It's funny. I was going to ask as my next question what the weather predictions are. We've all been watching it so carefully, but you really can't get an eye on it until a couple of weeks before. And that generally seems to be the consensus. Now, you said you thought the boys could rip it up. Besides the par fives, where are the holes that are vulnerable to scoring?
Well, if there's no wind, I think they're all vulnerable. And the reason I say that is because the fairways are about 50% wider than normal U.S. Open fairways. The USGA did not require Erin Hills to change its fairway width. So they're not gigantically wide fairways, but they are plenty wide. And if, these guys like Dustin Johnson and Jason Day and Rory McIlroy, if they're all healthy, the way they bomb the ball, if they hit it reasonably straight, they're going to have no problem scoring on this course. The course has been closed to the public. It's a public golf course, but it's been closed all year. So the greens are in absolutely perfect condition. There's not a ball mark on them. And even Mike Davis said a couple of weeks ago when he came in for media preview day, he said, you're going to see a lot of putts made on these greens. So, give Dustin Johnson wedges in his hands and no wind and those guys like that, and they're going to make birdies. There's no doubt.
I noticed that there's a bunch of places where we already have a drivable par 4 and a bunch of places where they could move the tees up and make either a par 4 drivable or a par 5 reachable in 2. Which holes in particular stand out in your mind as being great risk-reward holes like that on the golf course?
Well, number 2 is a short par 4, and they're going to make it drivable at least one day, maybe 2. From the front tees, it'll be about 280 to 300 yards. So, obviously a lot of the big hitters can get home with no problem, but it's risk reward because it's actually a blind tee shot over a ridge. And the green is on a little tiny mound. It's a small green, about 4,000 square feet. And it's perched atop this little mound in the middle of a valley. And when people see that green site and green complex for the first time, they think surely it was pushed into place by bulldozers, but no. The glaciers left that behind, this little mound in the middle of a valley, and they put a green on it. So you miss the green and you're going to be in a tightly mown surround where you're going to have different options to try to get up and down, or in a bunker or in fescue somewhere that's, you know, navel high. So that'll be a fun hole to watch. And then the other drivable par four, at least one day, is going to be number 15, which you tee off from an elevated tee. And it's about a 300-yard carry to an elevated green surrounded by really nasty bunkers. And interestingly, Jay, that hole was a pivotal hole in the championship match of the 2011 U.S. Amateur. It played at 253 yards. Patrick Cantlay decided to lay up with an 8-iron and hit it into a fairway bunker and made bogey. Kelly Kraft won the hole and went on to win the championship match 2-up. So there's a little history behind that hole.
I like both of those holes a great deal. I like 2 especially because that squared off green seems very Seth Rayner-esque.
It does.
You made a great point when you said that it's amazing that nature left it that way. These guys didn't use bulldozers. They only moved 50,000 cubic yards of earth. That's nothing, considering that the average golf course moves somewhere between 250,000 and 400,000. As we said before, it is minimalist. They maybe knocked the top off a mound here, they shaped a fairway there, and they maybe carved out a few little things, you know, maybe some of the lower spots erased some of the higher spots, but that was about it. Really only touch-up work on 4 holes. The rest of it, like you said, they just sort of laid the holes over the canvas that was already there. Now, I also have my eye on number 14, a par 5 with a fairway shaped like a reverse question mark, which has all sorts of angles. You can count out your angles on that hole, which is unusual because it's very different from, say, 13 at Augusta, where if you try to lay up, it's very similar to 13 at Augusta, whereas if you lay up, you have a harder shot into the green than if you go for it. So it really wants to tempt you, to try to hit it in 2, but if you play safe, it's going to be a little tougher. I find that hole fascinating as well.
Yeah, that hole is really interesting because the green, originally it was going to be a par 4, and then when all the brush and trees were cleared on the site, the architects noticed a little shelf in a hill, halfway up a hill, and they said, man, that would make a great green complex. So they backed up the tees, and they turned it into a par 5. And I'll tell you what, that green complex is one of the wilder ones you'll ever see in a major championship. It's a shelf set in the middle of a hill. It's a giant two-tiered green with a huge swale in front of it and runoffs on all sides, kind of a backstop and back. I've seen guys, you know, fly the green with their third shots or with their second shots if they're going for it. The ball smacks into this hill, rolls back down onto the green, and they have a birdie putt. So anything can happen on that. You'll see eagles and birdies, and you'll see 6s and 7s, no doubt.
And just before we go to break, one last hole that also comes to mind. I'm a big fan of using reverse camber as a natural defense in golf, very much like Olympic club. And the 8th hole at Erin Hills has a wonderful reverse camber to the fairway, which means you have to place your drive with both great distance and accuracy both.
That's a really good point. It's a blind tee shot over a giant glacial ridge, and the fairway canters from left to right pretty severely, but turns as a dogleg to the left. So, you know, caddies will tell first-time players, now I want you to aim over the left rough line, even into the left rough, and hit your ball over that hill, and it's going to wind up in the fairway. And I've seen many guys who doubt that tip from the caddies, and they hit one right down the middle, and they think their ball is going to be in the middle of the fairway. They get over the hill, and it's run into the right rough, and they have nothing. So, yeah, that's going to be – and the second shot is no piece of cake. It's to an elevated green with 3 gigantic deep-face bunkers in front of it. So even if you're hitting a short iron into that green, it's not an easy shot. So that's going to be an interesting hole, too.
Everybody, this is Gary D'Amato. He's going to be reporting live from Erin Hills. I'm Jay Flemmer. You're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network. We will be right back after this.
That bump music means we're going to have to take a short break. Don't go away. We'll be back at the second half of the show in just a minute.
This is your main man, DJ Q, and you're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network.